This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Took last week off, but we are back and ready and rolling this week. Had a fun last couple weeks, actually. Went to action, did a double shot last weekend, went to Action Wrestling in Tyrone, Georgia, brought Ava on her first road trip. We went about 2 hours down, actually, I say 2 hours, it was about 3.5 hours with Atlanta traffic. Those of you who've driven in Atlanta know the joys of rush hour Atlanta traffic. It's about 100 miles down and took us 3.5 hours to get down there. It was a rough trip down, but thankfully she slept in the car on the way down. But Action Wrestling is worth it. If you guys ever get a chance to make it down to Action Wrestling, Matt Griffin puts on a heck of a show. Saw two very good matches. If you guys get a chance to watch them on independentwrestling.tv, AC Mack versus Kurt Stallion in the main event was an absolute banger. AC Mack, we've had on the show. He is one heck of a wrestler. He's getting better every single time he gets in the ring, and Kurt Stallion needs to be in your top 30 next year for your lists. He's killing it in Evolve, and he's killing all over the indie scene. I'll talk about him in a minute as well, because in the next show I saw he was very good as well. And then AJ Gray, another improving wrestler, but on a heck of a match against Slim J. Slim J is in the Scenic City Invitational, and that was a really good, sneaky good match. At Action Wrestling. So those are two matches you're going to need to go out of your way to see from the Action Wrestling show. The next night, I went to New South. New South is a promotion out of Alabama. They are another one that kind of sneaks up on you. A lot of people don't talk about them, but they are getting a lot better. They put on a show at a really cool theater. Those of you who are at WrestleMania weekend remember the White Eagle Hall. They put on a theater at a venue that was very similar to White Eagle Hall in Fort Payne, Alabama. And I saw a card where every match was surprisingly good. I saw some very good talent. And their main event was Tyler Matrix, who is another one who needs to be on your radar. He's a kid. He trained out at OVW a little bit. And he worked Kurt Stallion in the main event. They had one heck of a match. And I think they're getting their stuff on IWTV as well. And they, that's another one you need to go out of your way to see. So did a double shot last weekend. Wrestling road trips are fun. You guys, and Fort Payne, Alabama was only an hour from me as well. You guys, if you get a chance, see independent wrestling. There's even the bad cards are fun and the good cards are great. One thing too, if you are in Alabama, in that northern Alabama area, one thing I need to bring up because it's an absolute blast. There is a place in Scottsboro, Alabama called Unclaimed Baggage. Basically what it is all of the baggage that doesn't get claimed gets sent to this one place in Scottsboro, Alabama, which is the middle of nowhere. So all of the unclaimed, like the shirts that get lost and the electronics that get lost and all the sort of stuff that gets lost and never gets picked up by people from their baggage gets sent to this one big old warehouse, basically. And get sold at a ridiculous discount in Scottsboro, Alabama. It's a total find. So you get like I got a Kindle there for like $50. That was like a $300 Kindle. You get the one find they had there this time was like NFL jerseys that were like wrongly printed and stuff like that, and they were $6 a piece. And I like to sleep in football jerseys. So, like, right now I'm wearing a misspelled Jimmy Garoppolo jersey because they only have the one R in the middle, and it cost me $6. I found, like, some Patriots jerseys that just didn't have the numbers on the front, and those were $6 a piece, too. I found some, like, Nautica polo shirts for, like, $10. They have hats. I got a Red Sox World Series hat for $6 that was in my size. It was fitted. It just fell. I mean, literally just fell out of baggage. It was great. It was new. Had the tags on it. And this place is really, really cool. So if you're in Scottsboro, Alabama, it's an hour from Chattanooga. Those of you who are coming for Scenic City, it's worth the trip. It's really cool. It's really, really cool. It's just this one little warehouse area there. They have different stuff all the time. They rotate stuff in and out all the time. The electronics, you can get phones super cheap. You can get, I got a pair of Beat headphones for like $50, Beats by Dre headphones for like $50. You get all this sort of stuff just at a ridiculous knockoff. So that's my recommendation for the week. But this week, we have a heck of a show. I have my blood brother, basically, one of my best friends on the planet, and one of the biggest wrestling fans I know, John Filipowicz. If you guys know the name, he wrote, directed, and produced the documentary Barbed Wire City. It is the fans' perspective documentary on ECW. And he is also one of the most active fans on Twitter and one of the just genuine good guys in the wrestling community. Johnny P., thank you for coming on, my friend.
Thank you for being nice to me. I'm not sure if any of these things are true. I think some of them may be detriment, but I'm willing to come on just for you.
No, I appreciate it, my friend. Seriously, you're just a genuinely good soul, and you have a heck of a story in wrestling. You're based out of Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is literally the mecca of sorts for you know, in the Philadelphia area, and home of a lot of those old WWF tapings and stuff like that. So you have seen some stuff.
Well, it's good. It's good spacing. It's like being on a good NBA team where they run the triangle. Because literally, I was trying to explain this to our mutual friend Pete. He was asking me how far we're away from New York for like the WrestleMania thing, and how far from Philly because he was flying in there. And I just sent him a screenshot, and I had drawn with the app. I had drawn the triangle that makes New York to Allentown to Philly and then back up. And I was like, I'm an hour 15 really from both these days. So I get for the longest time up until like this decade, it was like the wrestling world was run out of either Philly or New York. So
yeah, it's not fair, man.
I got lucky.
It's not fair.
And by the end of this story, we'll talk about how I've been driving 8 hours to see the wrestling I want in the type of atmosphere I want. So at the end of the day, you know, everything is transient.
Well, you started real early, basically, as a wrestling fan. You started around the same time I started. You fell in love, basically, 87, 88, right?
Yep. And I didn't remember that until I, like, backtracked, like, a decade later and tried to, like... Because you're a kid. You're like, we were so young when we started because of living in the Northeast. They were like, when was it that I started? Because you see pieces of things as a kid. You're not, like... Mm. I guess you're a sentient being. Sentient isn't the word, but like you're not all there. You don't really know what's going on or what's on what channel or when something comes on. But yeah, I had kind of like sent you over like me trying to remember everything. I'm finally starting to like write these things down because, you know, like we were both saying, our memories are crap. But I know I would see all the magazines. I was an After magazine mark at the newsstands, and they both scared me, but like fascinated me, these like crazy big bloody men, and that combined with, oddly enough, the Hulk Hogan cartoon, I was just like, this is wrestling.
Oh, that was chum for us, man. That Hulk Hogan, yeah. That Rock and Wrestling was Hulk Hogan, what was the name of it? I mean,
it was something like Rock and Wrestling. Yeah. It might have been Rock and Wrestling Connection or something
like that. And it's on the
I remember
network,
when I heard the name going, no, that wasn't it, but it actually is. I looked it up, and it's something like that.
It's on the network now, and I mean, God love it. Yeah, that was total chum for us.
Was it
we
really?
We were kids.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was, what, 5 at the time in 87 when that came on, or 86 when that came on, and that was just like total, just in my wheelhouse. Because, I mean, I watch wrestling, and it came on Saturday mornings. And Saturday mornings, I'd watch cartoons, and that was a cartoon. And then I'd watch wrestling. And then I'd go out and play basketball. And you're a basketball head like I am, too. So that was just like, that was my weekend, man. You know, like, that's what I do.
Well, it really was helpful to be a kid. And the minute cartoons ended, they're like, here's wrestling. You're like, all right, I'm sticking around for this. I hope mom and dad aren't listening in.
Yeah, this is also for me, you know?
And I like isolated down. It was like my proudest moment, like a year or two ago, with everything like now on YouTube. Like I was a tape trader starting in like 97 when I was 16. I acquired an ECW Arena Fans tape set of ECW starting the week that Shane Douglas threw down the belt. And this stuff was gold in 97. So I got so much mileage out of trading tapes from that like 3 year period of ECW TV, because it was the sports channel stuff.
Yeah.
So I was able to get all this stuff, and excuse me, I finally figured out, like, now everything's online and it's so freaking bizarre to have. It's like being the human being, the Tom Hanks in what's that movie? Not Castaway. Castaway.
Oh yeah.
Where at the I always thought because. Also, you know, as you mentioned, like I went to school for writing for film and television, and you know, kind of an amateur. Every 10 years, I make a film, and there's this great scene that we watched in class. We watched Castaway to like deconstruct it from a screenwriter's perspective, and they show him how hard it is for him to make fire on this island. Like he's a normal guy. How are you going to make fire? I thought that was brilliant. And then he goes home, and it's just like he's flipping a light switch on and off when he gets back to land. And that's what it feels like to be in, like, we're now old heads, which is so freaking weird, to be, like, old heads in the scene, in the community. And all these tapes you scoured for and that you, like, beg people, and then you get, like, either a crappy fourth-generation version of, or, like, somebody screwed you on a trade, or you could just never find it. Or there'd be a guy who has everything, but he was so, like, underground because he was afraid of getting, like, sued, that it was impossible to get to unless you knew the right person.
Yeah, it's on my phone.
Yeah, now you can just hit a button on any device and find it. And I found the first angle I remember, which was I sent it to you. It was Andre, like clears out some jobbers and Hacksaw. He won't leave the ring, and Hacksaw runs in. It was like a wrestling challenge angle from like March '88, and he chokes Hacksaw to death. And I was captivated by this because they put the red bars. Remember when WWE would put the red bars?
Oh, yeah.
Like the big X to make you think it was worse than it was. And he's coughing up, I think he bit a condom, and he's coughing up blood. And then he takes the 2x4 from the ground and he hits Andre and falls on top of him. It's a very visceral angle. It's like really well done. It doesn't feel as, for wrestling, as stagey as today. And the crazy thing is that my friend Brad was in the audience as a child for that show and that angle. And when I talked about how crazy it was, he was like, oh my God, I was so scared for Hacksaw. I thought he was going to die. I thought it was just the coolest thing.
Yeah, what got me, like, the similar with the Red X was Black Bart stepping on Brutus Beefcake with the Spurs. And the Red X.
Okay, I only vaguely remember this, but I do know it.
Yeah. And the Red X, because that Red X could have meant anything. That Red X basically just meant he popped an artery, you know?
Right, because you couldn't see. So, especially as a child, you're like, oh, well, this must, like, again, you're not a real human
actual
being
death.
With, like,
actual death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just like, well, the TV company, whatever the TV company is, is allowing this to air, but also censoring it because death is involved.
Yes. Yeah. It was insane. It was absolutely insane. So you started your viewing with a bang. Your first pay-per-view was WrestleMania motherfucking 6?
Yes. Yes.
Dude,
which is still the coolest thing to me to this day.
How the hell in another country?
No. Like, well, I didn't go there. Like, I wasn't there.
I probably
wrote that in the note I sent you.
My first pay per view was WrestleMania 6 at the Sky Dome. I thought you went to the Sky Dome. Okay.
No. Like the paragraph after that is when I actually went to show. No. Oh. God, I wish. My parents wanted nothing to do with wrestling. I was sneaking.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
I had a fake uncle. Like, my mom's friend, who I called Aunt Rose, but there was no blood relation. She started dating this guy who was, as stereotypes go, he was this trucker dude. And nice enough guy. You know, like, looking back, like, today, Johnny P of today would have nothing to say to this person. He just sat there. He drank beer. He was this stereotypical, like, kind of hick dude. But he liked to watch wrestling, and it made it okay because an adult was watching wrestling. So my mom kind of relented. So as an olive branch, they would invite me over for things, basically. So, like, Keith would kind of feel accepted, and by me, because I was always with my aunt, and I got wrestling out of it. So it was like this perfect compromise we made.
Did I ever tell you the beer story about my first pay-per-views? Okay, so the first, starting at 4 and going through probably 8, my dad took me and my brother to Uncle Tommy. And Uncle Tommy wasn't actually an uncle, but Uncle Tommy was his best friend growing up. Kind of similar sort of deal, you know, single guy. Right. But he lived in a town that had pay-per-view because our town didn't have pay-per-view. So every year he would take us for the pay-per-views. And my dad called it man time. And my dad would buy us root beer in glass bottles and we'd pretend it was beer.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd pretend to be men and we were allowed to curse.
Okay.
And like we were allowed to say dirty words. And this was like the only time because we weren't allowed to say dirty words around mom. But we were allowed to say dirty words and, like, you know, just like, and be men.
And man, like, time absolutely sounds like something that would get you canceled in 2019.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. Totally. But this was just like, no, we were allowed to, like, be like, curse and, like, you know, and like pretend we were drinking beer. And like this. And it was like the most exciting thing ever for my brother and I, because we were like, you know, 7, 8, 9 year old kids at the time.
Right.
It was just like, it was the greatest fucking thing ever. And I got hooked on, like, I got hooked on wrestling because I associated this with, like, oh my God, I can say shit.
Right.
I can say the F word.
My mom was always concerned with, like, the three things that I remember my mom having, like, hesitation about that were, like, issues that I slowly kind of chipped away at with my dad's indifference helping out were wrestling, NFL football, and Howard Stern on the radio were three things that were like, my mom was not happy, but I kept kind of going back to it. And she just kind of, and I was a smart kid too. Like the minute I saw like Stern start to go sexual or something, I was like, oh, what's on like, you know, the local pop radio thing. Yeah. Mom, what do you want to listen to? You know? Cause I was like, better to cut bait now
than
have it canceled forever kind of a thing.
Yeah, I was a Stern.
And I feel that way with wrestling too.
I was a Stern, like, kid too when I started to be about like 12 or so, because Stern was on in Boston, and like I snuck it away from my mom because I'm just like, I'm listening to this and she knows I'm listening to this. I know that she knows I'm listening to this, but I'm just, it's a mutual understanding sort of thing, you know?
Because, well, yeah, my dad would listen, but then my mom would yell at him sometimes like, you're listening to this in front of your son and now he's listening and I don't like that. And my dad would go like, oh, my dad was like, so like, I could have had, we're lucky that I wasn't like a gun family or anything, because my dad's answer to anything that he just wanted selfishly for himself was just like, oh, he doesn't even get it. He doesn't care. Like, my dad's the type that absolutely would have had guns like laying around, like, Jesus, you know, Christ, fully loaded guns. I mean, like, we've never owned a gun, the family, but like he would have been, I totally would have been too lazy to put them away and be like, well, he understands not to pick it up and shoot it, you know? As I run around the house, like, going, bam, 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 you know, with my fingers, you know, or something.
So you're in Allentown, which is the home of Ag Hall.
Correct. And I lived 3 blocks from the actual Ag Hall.
My God. That's amazing.
Yeah. You would, so Ag Hall is short for Agricultural Hall, because by the time I was old enough, it really wasn't, it was only a thing during the Allentown Fair, which is like the last week of summer before Labor Day. They would have like livestock there and do like a 4-H big show thing as part of the fair. And it slowly became like very weird because like I lived in a city, I lived in a row home, 2 blocks from the entrance, I guess it would be the east entrance of the fairgrounds, which is a pretty big complex where the fair would be. And on the other side of the complex was Ag Hall, which is like 3 blocks. By the time I'm like, it's like 1990 or whatever, it's very archaic, number one. But number two, the idea of like an agricultural hall in like this growing city, because in the late 80s, they built what they call the Blue Route, which was the turnpike going down to Philly. Mm-hmm. And they also extended I-78 through the Lehigh Valley, and that goes straight to the tunnels at New York. So, like, as you know, Pete and I didn't stay in the New York, North New Jersey area for WrestleMania. We commuted from my house. So they built this place that then became the city that all these people were coming to. Like, we grew up.
Yeah.
And they still have, like, this Ag Hall thing there. So it gets used for livestock, like, once a year, and otherwise it's, like, rented out for, like, actual, like, more modern city things, so
sure,
to speak.
Sure. Now, you, in the thing you sent me, you said you went to 2 Pennsylvania Championship Wrestling shows, but you didn't go to any WWF tapings there, did you?
So I went to Ag Hall for my first ever show, okay, which I found out was September 13th, 91. And if you look at the card, yeah, it's very much a C show. This is like right after SummerSlam, the match made in heaven, the match made in hell one. It's the one with the Mountie and the Boss Man, where ends up like locked in jail.
Okay.
So now they do the house show loops with it, but they're doing it as the C show, as the main event. So I saw the big blue cage as the main event of my first show, and I bought a ugly light purple Ultimate Warrior shirt.
Amazing.
At that. And as far as the PCW things, those were in Hamburg. Hamburg was the other place. So Ag Hall is where the WWF tapings were from around 72, 74 until 83. In fact, the last few tapings, I would have been living there by that point. I would have been 2. The other place they taped was the Hamburg Fieldhouse, which is about 30 minutes up a highway. And I was lucky enough to go to that venue and watch Blaine DeSantos's Pennsylvania Championship Wrestling in the late 90s, like 90, I think they were both 99 shows.
Gotcha.
1999. And those were the cool, like, that venue is even cooler to me than Ag Hall. Like, it's just such a neat old venue. And I think that's the venue where the Snuka Piper angle took place, as I recall.
I think it might
the
be.
The coconut angle.
Yeah, I think it might be.
Because the backdrop falls of Piper's Pit, I'm almost positive that's not the backdrop of Ag Hall. That's the backdrop of the Hamburg Fieldhouse.
But then you fell in love.
Yes.
See, you, again, being in Philly, you're so lucky because you caught ECW at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that, though, at the time.
Well, I know that. I mean, obviously, yeah. But like you caught Eastern. It was Eastern Championship Wrestling when you caught it, right?
Yeah, so like I said, like, I've kind of cobbled this together through the year. I've had to think about it a lot because I had to do all that press, the press interviews for Barbed Wire City. I knew that I had seen pieces. Like, there's things to this day I can quote that was like Public Enemy doing skits where they went to a country club and pretended to be Paul Heyman. There was a very long interview that went on forever that was Shane Douglas that I later found out was from, I think, early 90, maybe late 94, early 95. And they just, something happened with the tape. They taped like an episode and the tape got screwed up. And in a panic, Paul got Shane to like come up to New York and just record like a 35-minute interview, which is the bulk of the entire show. And at the time, it was this massive revolutionary thing, but it was happenstance. So I would see things like this. I didn't become a full-time viewer until mid-1995. But the important thing to note, which is what you were originally talking about, is I got Sports Channel Philadelphia. So, yeah, I was seeing ECW before it was syndicated anywhere. And I became a regular viewer in mid-95, right around the time Malenko and Guerrero were leaving and Ray Hoovy and all the Mexican luchadors were coming in.
So as someone who's only known WWF, talk about the impact that ECW has on you, how different it is, because you're entering your teenage years too. Like, how does it, because that was the thing, ECW hit me right in the hormones, not just like sexually, but like as like a budding teenager, like
visceral violence,
visceral,
like,
violence,
in your face.
Yeah.
The music, the music that we as like being part of youth culture, that was the DIY show. Like, I didn't like the cleanness of WWE, because especially then it was just campy, cleanly produced garbage. And this felt produced like a music video. This was Nine Inch Nails. This was, you know, House of Pain. This was Elastica, all the songs that they were using. This was like a wrestling show as a music video infomercial, like just Liquid Television. It was like MTV's Liquid Television, which is another reference people our age would understand.
Yep.
I don't know that I can properly, without, you know, being verbose and going on like I always do, which I'm not going to. I'm just going to use that as a placeholder and say, to a younger fan, there's a lot of fans in this right now who have no idea that, like, they're like, okay, I've heard of ECW. And I'm like, well, yeah, I produced this documentary about it. And they're like, what is Barbed Wire City? That was only 6 years ago. But this influx of your New Japan, PWG fans, plus just age, like, you know, the churn and the age group that comes in more. A lot of people our age don't start now, but a lot of people who are younger start, you know, every year. It's really hard to tell those people because it looks dated. And you know how you guys all feel about being the Elite? Imagine if that was an hour long and had all the coolest music that you all agreed on because there was more of a monoculture back then. And it pulled from all the different things that only youth would be into, because once you get to be in your 30s, you're not deeply into the hip-hop scene, like underground scene, plus deeply into, you know, industrial music and deeply into hard rock.
Do you I go back and watch ECW now, and it feels a little cringe and a lot dated. Do you agree or disagree?
Yes, on this, as a macro answer, yes. But I am vaguely protective for somebody who doesn't even really go back and watch a lot of it. The funny thing is, I'm a very leave the memories alone kind of person with it. I do go back in special time. Like, just there's something that we're probably going to mention. Maybe it'll get cut, but for time. But like, I just watched the PCO match that I referenced from like 2000. I sat front row for. Mm-hmm. I went back and watched that. I think in February with a friend down in Greensboro. And it's like, wow, this is still really neat. There's a lot of stuff with the language and the attitude and angle. The fans are very cringe. And I felt that, I mean, even in 2013, before like culture changed and, you know, you and I, like, I think it's fair. I hope I'm not hurting your cred by saying we're both pretty liberal dudes.
Yeah.
I don't know that we're like deeply, deeply woke people, but we are definitely more in line with that than we would be with, like, you know, stark conservative culture. And having said that, though, like, there is stuff, even in 2013 when I was, or 2012, I guess, when I was editing together all the stuff about the crowd and everything for Barbed Wire City, it was embarrassing to watch and having to keep clipping and having, like, a timeline that was just, like, chair shots, a timeline of fans chanting it, Francine. There's nothing worse than, like, sitting in Francine's home and interviewing her, and she's like a sweetheart of a woman and a mom, and, you know, we're gonna have a pizza party after the video shoot, the interview, and talk about people chanting she's a crack whore. Yep. You know, it's just bizarre. It is. I defended it at the time being younger because I was like, well, they don't mean it, blah 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 blah, like, I don't do that, and I like don't rape women, so it's okay. And now I'm like, well, just because you don't sexually assault people doesn't mean you need to be doing that. You know, like, I certainly, it's not something I'm proud of now as, like, being a fan. I didn't sit around chanting she's a crack whore to anyone, for the record, everybody. I definitely chanted ECW at stupid things, though, that I'm like, well, and normally they were, like, guys doing dumb things to pop a crowd and hurting themselves. And it's like, well, why?
And we still do that because we're both fans of Joey Janela, so, you know.
He's that's another story. I'll let Mr. Janela be.
Yeah, we still love Joey. So anyways, going forward, so ECW is your first love. You went to a bunch of ECW shows. Yes. We won't go through them all, but just go through some of the highlights on some of the cards there. What are your top five favorite ECW moments that you've seen?
Okay,
live?
So for live, like, my first show was, again, Ag Hall. Thank you, Paul Heyman, for having grown up a WWF fan. And he really, really wanted – I read an interview with him in 96 where he was so bummed out that Ag Hall really just didn't hit. But there was actually a TV taping that I missed because I was still young. I was 15. And I didn't feel comfortable going by myself because it was kind of this thing I did on my own, watching wrestling. And they did a TV taping in May of 96 that I didn't go to. that had like Jericho and a bunch of people on it. He wanted to make that like a normal TV spot. And he was just bummed out that Allentown just wasn't what he thought it would be for TV. That first show is amazing. I'll throw that on there because the Tommy Dreamer, Brian Lee, they had this violent brawl that went outside and it was just nuts. You really felt like you were in the middle of some crazy riot that felt vaguely controlled, so you weren't in total fear, but that then was nuts enough that your adrenaline went. It was crazy. You felt like something could happen. Now, the ugly side of that, and I'll throw this into memory, is I was at a show that Dylan Hales has also talked about because Dylan and Papa were there. For some reason, Dylan and Papa did a northeast swing when Dylan was 5th. Dylan and I are exactly the same age. We're 6 months apart. And Dylan and Papa were in the audience in July 97 at Ag Hall when somebody grabbed Francine, touched her inappropriately in the front row, and Douglas pushed the guy, and then the guy like tried to jump the rail and attack Douglas. And a riot started, like a mini riot. And I know those are always so, like, people say that hyperbolically in the same way that everybody and their mother told me during my tapings for interviews for Barbed Wire City that they broke their neck. And everybody had the same story of, I walked to the hospital, and then they were like, you walked here? You shouldn't be unable to do anything. You broke your neck. And it's this weird hyperbole thing.
Yeah.
So I want to be careful when I say riot. Like, it was inches from being completely out of hand. Like, Tracy Smothers and Candido, who had just worked the match, like, one or two before against each other, they ran out in literal towels. Like, they were, like, showering. They ran out and started punching fans. And there was a group of fans that, like, were fighting back, and it carried out away from front row and out into this open space in the building, because the building was bigger than fans that were – than it was set up for fans, if that makes any sense. So that was scary, you know, but it was also like, oh, this is the other side of, like, my first show. You know, like, the Dreamer Brian Lee thing was a controlled crazy moment. This was an unexpected crazy moment. I got to see PG-13 versus Mikey Whipwreck and Spike Dudley. That was amazing.
So good. So good. Oh, anytime you see Jamie.
I started going to the arena in early 98. January 31st was my first show. I got to see Bam Bam turn on Taz and reform the Triple Threat. The big highlights were at the end. I saw Sandman's return, October 23rd, 1999. This would mean garbage, less than nothing, to modern fans. And even people back then, if you weren't an ECW fan, you're like, well, he's like a backyarder who has a cult following. I get you. I don't know how to – again, these things are kind of hard to like – transport to other things, like make analogous in some way, but like our boy coming home, lights on, lights off, Raven's already in the ring with Dreamer. Raven had just come home 3 months earlier. It was this last gasp of maybe the glory days of 1995-96 will come back. That was a big that was the biggest pop I ever heard in that building. It was a moment, and I know that it might seem silly to others, but it's to this day very special to me. And for the last one or two, let's see here. I'm going to like scroll through here. I saw Just Incredible versus PCO on July 8th, 2000. And it was funny because I was in the front row for it. I made my way to the front row. I sat front row, I think, three times. And we were like, oh my God, that's Jean-Pierre Lafitte. Like, wow, he's still around. And then he has this great match with Just Incredible, who was very underrated, in ECW, and then went to WWE, and like really just it didn't click. I'm a slight Just Incredible defender because I do think that his run was really doomed by time and place.
I think he has that Public Enemy thing where like he worked for time and place.
That's not shocking because I'm a huge Public Enemy fan and defender because it worked for that building, and it's like, well, I don't give a shit that it didn't work in crappy WWE in 1998, you know, like I also don't give a shit that like JBL worked for some people in 2005. You're paying me for me to sit through that. I'm sorry. I don't give a shit. So I just think it's great that I saw a match with him where we were all mumbling like, wow, I thought he was retired. I guess he still got it. And then last summer, and you were there in August of 2017, I watched this dude tear it up at SCI. I filmed ringside for that show. And was blown away by this dude killing it. And then you were in the building at MSG for this dude. So that's what, 18, 19 years.
And we sat together when we saw, because you sat next to me when he was against Walter when he had his, like, reawakening.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, I ran out of things to put on this document. Eventually going to keep it for myself and put everything. So thank you for reminding me. So, yeah, there's all this interconnectivity with us and our history. Yeah. Watching this guy over the course of now, it's 30 years.
Yeah.
And the last thing I'll say is I was there, sadly, December 23rd, 2000, for the final ECW Arena show, ECW Arena show. And that was weird because it was 2 days before Christmas and dudes were not getting checks for Christmas. And it was kind of like a weird bomb threat. Like, and what I mean by that is the building was always packed to the gills because they papered it. That was a dirty little secret. Mm-hmm. My dumb ass was paying like $35 for ringside. And they were papering it to get standing room. And that was sad because it was kind of a funeral. You kind of knew it was dead. And I didn't want it to go, even though I was past the style at that point. And actually, from everything I've been told, so was Heyman. But that sucked, you know.
So
it's a special building.
Since we're on the topic of ECW, let's talk about the documentary.
Sure.
You're a fan. And your documentary, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's called Barbed Wire City. It's from the perspective of fans, which it's in my wheelhouse in this podcast.
I'll push back on that a little bit.
Like, okay.
Only because, like, I've heard people say that before. And I know that you and everybody who's ever said that is trying to, A, differentiate it, and B, pay me a compliment. But it has fans in it, absolutely, and their perspective is told. But I think I took a lot of heat for putting a lot of journalists in there. Because I felt like, you know, you watch a documentary about the Rolling Stones in the 70s or the rock culture, and, you know, you're going to get rock journalists. So why don't I have wrestling journalists? I had a lot of wrestlers in there. There's something like 65 interviews I did, and 59 of them make it into the doc.
Let me rephrase it. It was the most fan-friendly of all the ECW documentaries. Fair, and it told the stories of ECW fandom better than any ECW documentary.
Oh, my favorite part, or like the parts that don't make me cry because they're not as sad, mm-hmm. are the Tony Lewis parts, and that's a fan organizer. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we definitely had people from, like, you know, that were involved in CyberSlam. I mean, even like a Dave Shearer, who went on to be a prominent journalist on the East Coast, or Mike Johnson, who was a Front Row fan who became a journalist. Like, they're both in there, and Shearer was what they called the Bleacher Bums at the time, and they're like the original internet kind of mutant guys who kind of embraced the derisive attitude of others online in the early days of ECW and called themselves mutants. So yeah, it's all in there.
I just think it tells the story of what it was like to be an ECW fan. Let me rephrase. And it's in the wheelhouse of what
I'm sorry, I'm making things difficult for you, by the way.
No. But my point is, What made you say, I'm going to do this documentary? I guess is my question here. What makes you say, you know what, I love this thing so much that I'm going to make a documentary on it?
And
how does your brain work going into it? What's the process? Talk to me about that.
I think part of the reason I pushed back on it is because when I made it, it was going to be kind of a fan journal thing. And it, as is infamously been told and now forgotten because life moves so quickly, the film took 13 years to get made, and that's because a lot of the middle years it lay dormant. You know, like another project we were going back and forth about earlier before we got on the air that is kind of sitting on my shelf now.
Well,
which is again affiliated with wrestling, because I have no luck with wrestling documentaries. I should just never touch wrestling. I started it as a fan because they were still running. I was at and filming at the last CyberSlam in April of 2000. I have some of the footage. I think it may or may not have made it into the film. It's been years since I saw the Barbed Wire City. But I have footage from the front door looking in at the ECW Arena because I knew it was the last show and I wanted to remember it. When I came back to it in 2012, I wasn't making it as a fan anymore. I was making it as a documentarian, as, you know, like an investigative journalist of sorts.
Yeah.
So it ended up being a lot less rosy than it might have been. Because I do think it's a great underdog story. But I also think it's a very sad human story about making your dreams come true, or getting to this level that you're told is what the dream is, and then it just kind of falling apart because that's not enough to sustain anything. and then buying into your own, like, it's almost like, you know, those teen movies we grew up with, or teen romantic rom-com series that we grew up in. It's like Dawson's Creek, you finally get Joey Potter, and then it's just like, well, this makes me miserable, but isn't this what it's supposed to, isn't this the goal? So I can't leave. And then it all falls apart around you, and Joey Potter becomes a heroin addict or something. I don't know.
This got real dark, brother.
Yeah, I know, but that's life, brother. I mean, let's all wear football helmets or something, and mow the lawn and cry.
But I think everyone should watch it if and when it's available. You should make it available.
I should do something about that. Yeah, there's like the reason it hasn't is just because of my. I feel real weird about the project in general because of a few things that happened. Once it came out, mm-hmm. On the backside, it's nothing to do with like people or anything, but if there's a question of whether it can stream contractual thing, and like, so let me put it this way. Kevin Kiernan is my lifelong best friend and my film partner in Spaceship Brain Productions. I drug him through this process. He has never been a wrestling fan, and yet he can speak about the business more thoughtfully and articulately than most of the hardcore fans can, because he doesn't have that fan thing that like makes him irrational.
Yeah.
And his whole dealings have been with like workers and promoters and everything. So he's never had this, like, maybe this will happen, you know, kind of like pie in the sky thing. He and I are like one side of things. And then there's like people who we had to split from immediately after. We knew it was coming, but we were kind of locked into things. Once you do the Kickstarter thing, the double-edged sword is now you're like locked in contractually to people and everything. And so there's like things that I wasn't in charge of. Like, everybody thinks I'm doing everything because I'm the front-facing person and I'm the creative person from it. But there's like business things that I can't like
tied to stuff. Yeah.
So like, I don't want to go on too much about this because we have other stuff that's more interesting to get to. But like, so for instance, like Todd Gordon, the original owner of ECW, like doesn't like me anymore. Like doesn't speak to me.
Gotcha.
And it's because he didn't get a DVD as like a pre-screener thing. He was supposed to get it like a day or two after the premiere. I did not control that. That was all by somebody else out of Northeast Philly.
Sure.
He didn't get it, and he wrote me this really terse email yelling at me. But I wrote him back and said, I'm so sorry, Todd. Like, I literally don't have a copy of my own documentary at this moment. It was like 10 days after the premiere.
Sure.
I was doing media, but I didn't have a copy of it, and I have no way to control that. But everybody thinks it's me because they only know me.
Gotcha.
So, but that's, yeah. So that's the whole thing with that. I am proud of it. Now I've passed my dark period with it, and I'm back to like having pride in it and thinking it says a lot about wrestling, and it's not just like a fan propaganda thing. It's really, to me, it's something that says something about the beauty of people coming together and misfits rising up and forming their own like subculture. But it also says something about like the sadness and hardships of wrestling. And about winners and losers in life, honestly, because Heyman in a lot of ways came out. I mean, Jesus, he's still relevant now more than ever.
He got hired last week.
Right. And there's other people who were like really articulate and thoughtful that you wouldn't think so in our documentary in 2001 that then were interviewed at that fan thing and show that we were allowed to tape in 2012. And two of those gentlemen especially, like, which I really think are the heart of the doc, are Axel Rotten and Balls Mahoney. And I looked at the footage when we got home, and Kevin said, I cannot believe what's happened to those guys. And I said, dude, we're going to get a call that one of them is dead in the next 5 years. I just know it, and it breaks my heart. And I remember saying that and thinking, this is a little bit hyperbolic, John. Maybe it's just a bad weekend or a period. And I got calls from both times. I think it was Mike Johnson, who I became friendly with through the documentary, who called to inform me that Axel had passed, and then 2 months later that Balls had passed, and neither made it to the fifth year that I had predicted. And that's just heartbreaking. So I'm proud of that. It shows that because it's real and it's human and it's a reality, but it doesn't make me like, yay, that happened. You know, I don't want to see that. I thought they were lovely guys. I genuinely enjoyed them, but I will say that it broke my heart to interview them both the second time.
So in the wake of ECW, in the ashes comes Ring of Honor.
Right on.
And Ring of Honor is Philly-based, too.
Yeah, and it evolved out of RF Video needing to replace that income that came from having the licensing rights to all those ECW shows.
You're at the first show.
Yeah. Yep. And I knew all the players because I'd interviewed them for the documentary.
So you were around for that, for the beginning and the really the first many years of Ring of Honor. Talk about your love affair with Ring of Honor.
I was friendly with Gabe at the time. This is before Gabe was a big deal in wrestling. And when I say friendly, like, look, I wasn't going to hang out, but like we'd see each other at shows all the time. He would just bounce around shows and be, and I guess eventually he was kind of helping to scout talent and whatever. But at the time he was just, you know, he was announcing on Carino PWF shows, or like I'd see him at a CZW thing or this or that, or I would just, we'd see and talk to those guys, and I'd see Rob because Rob really wanted to distribute Barbed Wire City. And I found out about the show and I talked to those guys about it, and I ended up coming down to see it with a friend, and I was blown away by the professionalism of it. I mean, this is, but now everybody does professional stuff from videography to, like, you know, it's amazing how far it's come. It's what I've always wanted.
But for its time, it was real good.
Yeah, they had guardrails. Nobody had guardrails. They had they had security. Nobody had security. They the show started on time all the time. It was nuts. If a ROH show started 10 minutes late, people were ready to kill. Dude, I sat outside the ECW arena and it would be 8:01. First of all, who the fuck is starting a show at 8 o'clock? But they wanted to be the cool hip nightclub. They didn't open the doors, and it's like 8 o'clock, and there's like no sense to the line, and it's like January, and I've been there for 4 hours, you know, because it's first come, first serve, you know, before I got a connection to get front row. So this place was amazing. And then they got Eddie Guerrero on the first show, and then the main event is Danielson. But my guy, you know, Danielson, Loki, who was the Sabu of his generation, and Christopher Daniels, who I just watched wrestle last night, who's still doing it, who is a vet then. Oh my God!
Who hasn't aged, by the way, either?
Right, right. It's un-effing believable, dude. And then the third show, you do the farewell to Eddie, who has a really fun, cool match where he's going half speed to not kill himself because he's going back to WWE after being fired. Looks like next level. And it's the same day that AJ Styles shows up at ROH, and people sleep on AJ early on because he's a TNA guy to a lot of people. But AJ was the massive part of the first 2 years of ROH. And this is April of 2002. This is before TNA even exists. So those are amazing.
And then Samoa Joe comes in.
Yeah, yeah. I said, again, like, I can't help myself because I'm a big fourth wall breaker. And I think we all grew up on Stern, so. Yeah. And we all, meaning you and I.
Yeah.
So I can't help myself but say, I sent Ben, like, 40,000 notes. So he's going to do his best to, like, lead me through this as quick as possible. Yeah, Samoa Joe comes in October 2002. I had read about this guy, and I just started subscribing to The Observer in, like, May of 01, finally, after, like, getting pieces for years online. And I kept hearing about the Samoa Joe, and I'm like, oh, yeah, Samoans. Like, Allentown is also the home of the Wild Samoans. It's where Afa lived. And Afa's great, by the way. I almost did his TV production back in, like, 2002. I could have been buddies with Court Bear. That's the funny thing. I didn't know this until years later. Yeah, like I was a guest at his show through Bill Apter, and I got to like hang out and go out to dinner with them afterwards and everything. So like no disrespect to Pops is what I'm saying. Everybody called him Pops. But my idea of Samoans was just like guys who did a wild man gimmick and had a wide waist, we'll say. And did savage type of gimmick stuff. And Samoa Joe comes in, this guy I've been reading about who's in 01, and has this insane stiff fight that, like, by the way, watch it now, it's on YouTube, it's still nuts. In 2019 you watch this and go, this is good, and holy crap, they're kicking the crap out of each other. Him and Loki was unfreaking believable. And I'm pretty sure that was the same show. It might have been the show before, 2 weeks before, which was the Paul London Please Don't Die ladder match show called Unscripted. But one of those two shows is where Meanie, Blue Meanie and Jasmine have, what did they call that thing? 3PW ran the arena, and Punk and Cabana came in. They wrestled like the second match. They do their touring indie thing, and they're like, oh man, we got a long drive. We got to go back to Chicago. And then they go like four blocks over to the Murphy Rec and walk out and do a segment, a mic segment on ROH. And I think it was this show.
Did you know with Punk right away?
I was so, he said four words and I was like, this is my guy. I have a list and it's like 3 to 4 guys who I always like brag about to my friends to this day. I saw that guy and he was my guy well before, you know, that whole obnoxious like indie, I saw them before they were at CBGB's kind of guy. I'll do that from time to time. Punk was one of them. Danielson was one of them. John Moxley was one of them. And Joe to some degree, I guess. But he was the coolest to me. Yeah. He had something that nobody on the, nobody could talk on the indies.
Yeah, Punk and Danielson were my guys. Those were my rider guys. Yeah.
Right. To this day, like, I'll defend Punk. I don't care if he, like, stabs your baby. I'll tell you it's justified. I'm irrational. And the other cool thing about that show, by the way, that October Philly, the Glory by Honor show, the first one, is the infamous Insane Clown Posse appearance, where they were in town to do some show at some small club. They had a bus of fans, so they told Feinstein, because they were big wrestling fans. Mm-hmm. So they tell Rob Feinstein, like, look, we can guarantee you like 30 or 40 extra heads or something. They'll all pay.
They used to do this. Like, I heard this on Through the Years, which is a great podcast, by the way.
Unbelievable. Shout out Trevor Dame.
Yeah.
And oh God, I'm blanking on his name. And I used to listen to him on Joe Versus the World. But the other gentleman, Mayor GF or whatever his name is. I'm sorry, man.
No, I forget his name too. Yeah, I know who you're talking about though. Yeah.
He's an old head, so shout out to you, sir. But that was the thing that they would do. And like, so they come in, there's all these people who stand out. It is just, it's black people at a Klan rally. I'm not saying that ROH was a Klan rally. I'm just saying, like, I'm trying to, you know.
It stuck out like a sore thumb.
It's people sticking out like a sore thumb with their faces painted, Juggalo tattoos, and then they come out, and the funny thing is, they're like the nicest guys ever, from what I understand, the Insane Clown Posse. They do this match. They keep it short. They do everything they're supposed to do. They sell for and bump for the guys. They're way more capable than a lot of other people who have been in the ring and are supposedly pro wrestlers. They get out and leave. And then everybody not only boos them out of the building, they boo their fans. Their fans get up and leave and go back to the tour bus. Oh, so they pay for this one match to see their heroes. And they're flipping everybody off because, like, you know, Juggalos are, you know, kind of angry teenagers in their own right.
They're prickly.
They make wrestling fans, and they make wrestling fans seem normative. And wrestling fans are already, like,
hard to do.
We're already like on a certain spectrum, which leads us to do this for more than 3 years in our teen years. So it says something, you know.
Yeah.
That was surreal, watching that and seeing them all leave and get booed out of the building and leave en masse. No physical violence though. It was cool.
So just kind of going forward a little bit, you saw Joe Kobashi live in New York City. My God.
Yes. To this day, like I wrote on the notes, it's one of 3 or 4 matches that are the greatest matches I've seen all time and are on my all-time list on tape as well. I can't tell you. I know some people, there was a pushback with that one at the time. I don't know if you were around during that, like for that, within that.
It came
that.
In right after. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah. Cause like amongst newsletter people, it was like really contentious with that. I'm a ride or die Joe versus Kobashi guy. It was the most magical moment. But even years removed, I've watched that match, and it's like Joe is embodying – Joe had used a lot of the moves from All Japan mid to late 90s and then was embodying all of Kobashi's greatest opponents to try to beat him. And Kobashi was like, I'm not laying down. I'm not the old man. I'm the greatest of all time in this moment. You know, at that time, he was considered the greatest of all time. That shit all gets thrown around a lot now. And I respect that time moves forward, and I respect that there's a lot of – physical things that people can do in the ring. As far as having all the pieces for his era and doing what I want out of wrestling, Kenta Kobashi is easily top 5, if not number 1. And Joe at that time, people don't realize, because he's kind of a different, to some degree, a different guy now, I still think he can go. Joe, from 03 when he wins that belt until sometime in 06, is the best wrestler in the world. I know that seems insane because people's idea of what the best wrestler is now has a lot more to do with moves that you do. And hyperbole, because there's 80 different best wrestlers in the world these days. Joe was the consensus old school champion who carried a belt everywhere and was like, I'll jump the rail with my belt in your promotion and beat you up. That was never going to happen, of course, but that was the feeling.
But he could, yeah.
He was the last guy who felt like a territory champ who would show up on your show and fuck up your champ. night in, night out, he put in some of the most amazing matches. Somebody just recently posted a list of all Joe's stuff from 03 to 06. It's mind-blowing. That match means a lot to me to this day. Being there and being one of only 700, 750 people. Like, I took a dancer. I took a classically trained dancer from an art school who had never watched wrestling before, and she looked at me and said, I'm in love with this. I want to choreograph this. It was the coolest fucking night.
And then right on the heels of that is the CZW stuff, which is kind of when I, like, right around when I first got in, like, that was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Oh, emotion. Like, there's, the reason I said the thing about, you know, hopefully this theme will come around by the end when we talk about the last section. It's so hard for a jaded screwball like me who had gone to everything and had every tape of everything and had lived this and talked to death with people about it. When you love something so much, sometimes you bleed it out, especially if you're a more critical, analytical person. Like, I mean, you spend a lot of time around a good friend of mine, Dylan Hales.
Yeah.
And Dylan and I, you know, have a very, like, kind of dark look at the world and a very analytical look. And, like, a lot of times I think people like us are just looking at things to tear them down, and we're not. We're looking to burn it down to its purest distillation. I'm looking to be emotionally moved by this silly hobby that I have and walk away and go, fuck you, it's not silly. It's wrestling is life, man. It is amazing. It's sport. And this, so that's why the Sandman thing meant so much. People were spilling beers on people, hugging each other. They'd never met them because our guy came home. That's our guy. We don't give a shit that you all laugh at him and he's hardcore hack in WCW and that hardcore has been made to be nothing. That's our guy, and he's home with us. This was a soccer stadium. This is, you know, Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal, whoever the big teams are these days in the Barclays Premier League.
Yeah,
this that big game. This is Yankees Red Sox,
but on neutral fields.
Yeah, and you've got a bleacher section open for CZW fans with a banner behind them. They brought their banner from their home, and an ROH section on the other side. This place is bananas. There are chants back and forth, dude. There was a match that had a finish that half of us missed because we were all yelling shit back and forth.
Jesus Christ.
We all know, and this is ROH, and, like, I know people like to get snarky about, like, oh, the smart fans got full. Like, isn't the whole point? I'm glad we got out of this. I'm glad that fans now probably are laughing at me because it's turned inside on itself. But at the time, people like me were being mocked because if you're an ROH fan, you're an ROH bot, and you're this smug, arrogant, you know, connoisseur of wrestling who looks down on everything else. And, like, meanwhile, we dug all those people. You know what I mean? Like, we dug that Hero was there. We dug that Necro was around. We dug that we could finally loosen our ties and maybe have a casual Friday, you know? But we still wanted our guys to win. And Joe was part of it. And Joe was the guy. And then Danielson got involved as you go on. The fact that they won that first blow-off match at the April 06 Philly show at the Armory, the 100th show, that's one of the best shows top to bottom. It really is for ROH. And they win that. And then they do the blow-off, a Cage of Death match, which isn't like a Cage of Death at, if you're going to the old ECW arena for their December show, granted, to this day.
Yeah.
But that's not what we were looking for. They did a Cage of Death as War Games. It had War Games rules. J.J. Dillon came to flip the coin. And then Danielson turns and knocks out Joe to further their angle. And then Homicide, who's been courted all summer, comes in, saves the dude, the pop for that. Go back and watch the tape.
Oh, yeah.
The pop for that. They had, by the way, ROH somehow had shitty production somehow, even in these days, which made no sense to me. The pop is like 10 times better if you were there live. He wins, and then they do the Cornette angle off of that because Loki's supposed to come back because he wants three wishes, and he says no to Loki, and that starts Homicide's journey to get the title from Danielson at the end of the year. Oh, that was prime ROH. That was the good stuff.
Yeah, that's when I'm getting introduced to ROH, and I'm hooked because I was out of wrestling at that point, and I am hooked. I'm just because oh my god, that was so prime for me. That was so prime for me.
Right.
And I actually was at the show. The next show you were at the Manhattan Center show, Danielson and Morishima. I drove down to New York for that.
You saw that? Oh, but the August 07 one. Mm-hmm. You were in there too?
Yep.
I lost myself in that. I was yelling like it was a I was a sports dad.
Yep.
Those are the moments where I believe again. And believe doesn't mean you're some mark who thinks it's real. Mm-hmm. It's that you get emotionally wrapped up in it. And I hope, I know we're winding down on time. I hope that we get to some of the stuff at the end of this thing that's the non-ROH stuff afterwards. Because it's the third act for me as a fan.
No, totally. And no, we will. Don't worry.
And that's where I'm gonna reiterate this. So remember it. Danielson, Morishima, that they were all good. I saw several of them. And there were a few that I've only seen on tape. But that first match, the underdog Danielson, in that match going up against the monster who had been promoted throughout the internet, who was the big thing coming to America, Morishima. I that was huge. I was sitting there on the edge of my seat like a sports ad going, come on, avoid that. Because he was throwing bows. That's the match where he screws up his retina.
Mm-hmm.
He was throwing on him, and it was like, oh, my God, it felt so real. And not, real is not a literal term in that sense, but it was visceral. I loved it.
So just kind of moving forward, you stop, basically, at 09 when Nigel and Danielson leave.
I didn't put on my list. It's for another day because I did this for you, mm-hmm. but as I told you, it's going to be me. That's why it's heavier mm-hmm. than you needed.
Yeah.
But I stopped because, dude, I was up till 3:30 in the morning and then woke up and finished this list. I did try. Dave gets fired in October of 08. I'm at his last big show, which is coincidentally at the ECW Arena. It's the Glory by Honor show that year. It's a blow off of a few foods. It's good. A month later, he's canned. I tried to stick with it. I was at the Christmas time ECW Arena show where they let Danielson announce the HD HD Net taping. Yeah. I didn't like the new regime. I didn't like the people they brought in. I'm not trying to take a shot, but I'm going to say it anyway because I can't help myself, and it's germane to this. They brought in like the Young Bucks. They brought in Kenny Omega. They were trying a lot of. They brought in Bison Smith. None of those guys have ever hit with me.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm not disagreeing at all. And that's the thing too. Like I was, September.
I've seen some Kenny stuff. By the way, before everybody hates me, although I don't know that this is the feed of people who are going to yell at me. There are definitely Kenny Omega matches from New Japan I have liked. He's the new Davey Richards to me as far as a guy that's so frustrating because he has all the tools and sometimes he employs the tools and sometimes he goes, I just want to play a video game in real life. But at the time, I didn't want what they were presenting to me at that time. And I'm sorry, I cut you off. You were about to say something similar.
Really good analogy. Yeah, Davey Richards is a really good analogy.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I dropped off after the first couple of TV tapings at the arena. In early 09, I came back for that September 09 farewell to Danielson and Nigel because that feud meant so much to me.
How was those that guys?
Meant so much. Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Were you up on the stage, by the way, Ed and Chair?
No, I sat way back.
Okay. Well, I had like second to last row on the stage.
That was the one that Flair was supposed to be at, right?
I think it was. Yes.
Yeah. Flair was at it. No, I showed up.
It was during that time period. It's the one where Jim Cornette does come back.
Yes. That was the one Flair was at. I showed up. I paid for a Flair appearance because I had never gotten a Flair autograph before. And I showed up drunk. And 20 minutes late, and I didn't end up getting my Flair autograph, and they refunded me for the Flair autograph.
No. Well, you lucked out. This is during my, like, you're ruining my hero, like, never meet your heroes kind of thing. Because I'm just like, this is, Flair is an obvious whore.
Yeah.
This is like, and I know some people find that, like, my buddy Bruce Mitchell will always yell at me when I go back and forth with him about this, but, that article on the now defunct Grantland that detailed the legal wranglings of Flair over 20 years.
Oh yeah, it destroyed me.
It is. It's like, look, I knew half of it, but the other half I didn't.
And regardless, it was like it was confirmation of what you felt. Live read here for a second.
Which is like
all on paper.
The place of Nation Pop, the newest Marvel Age. The sarcastic.
And he was being a total prostitute with the first three parts covering the year. The Ring of Honor and like mispronouncing the names of guys. And he's like, all right, get the fuck out of here.
Awesome powers.
And then he stiffed Terry on some money.
Yeah, with a review of the
High Spots
with
Mike.
Is it better than Dark Phoenix? Is it really as bad as you remember? Maybe. You just have to listen. DC4U, the newest weekly comic show on the pop beat, brings its first monthly look at the current state of DC Comics, including Vertigo's retirement.
A bunch of us met up for the Hammerstein show in, I want to say, June or July. 2011, which
the new
episode
of Freak Out Drive-In. She welcomes
Davey.
Returning Scott Griscollo to watch the 2016
And it was like a 32-minute match,
movie.
And 10 minutes in,
Terrifier.
I literally leaned
over to a friend.
Our new
episode of NBA
friend,
Team, Adam Murray
and
Andrew Ritchie are here to reflect
so
on what has been
and
quite
said,
the week in the NBA
I
land.
I hate this match, and
on
I hate
a brand
being
new
here.
PTBN
Pops. And that's when I knew I had to leave,
because
I was just going to be a detriment.
Get together to discuss PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament.
You know,
on
I was going to
be
that guy.
The greatest,
so.
Greatest,
I moved
80s,
January 1st, 2010,
greatest song of the 80s
so,
tournament
I mean,
kicked off.
Made it
there'll be six polls a day posted for round one. You can get in the action on Facebook by searching PTBN
so
Greatest Song
I'm
of the 80s Tournament, liking the page. Be sure to weigh in. On the wrestling feed, on the Place to Be Nation podcast, Justin Scott and Steve Bender are back inside the home office for a dive at the 9:30-89 Madison Square Garden house show. And after a six-month hiatus, Steve Bender and Peter Winston reunite to discuss their 10 favorite single-season sports teams on the Adam Division podcast. In the ninth episode of Row 1, Seat 1, I bring on action wrestling champion AC Mack to the podcast. On PlaceToBeNation.com, PTBN's tribute to 94 is off and running with pieces on the Best Picture nominations for the Academy Awards and the 94 World Cup and the miniseries The Stand. Also, the excellent Network Adventure team is back with a look at ECW One Night Stand 2006. That was a fun show. Check out our social media pages and message boards at Bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining the GWWE pay-per-view and TV match ever project. Get in the conversation today and start researching your lists. So you finished up with Ring of Honor. It looks like you got a little bit into Evolve and DG USA, but it wasn't really your bag.
Yeah, I tried. I tried to follow Gabe there. I tried to recapture some magic because a bunch of us met up for the first show at the old ECW Arena in July of 2009. And it was fun. I went back in November. The biggest find was Jon Moxley in a dark match. And the crazy thing is, I was looking it over, and the other dark match was Kyle O'Reilly versus Adam Cole, and nobody cared. Nobody cared. but
those people. What happened to those guys?
Yeah, they went on and did something or other. Yeah. I just couldn't, I think the last one I went to for forever was really the farewell to the ECW Arena that they ran, and we literally just hand-waved the show and didn't care. And, like, the amount of stars on that show is flat. Like, Gargano had a match with Ricochet, and we were like, get out of the ring, you bums! We just didn't care. And then, of course, that's the night on a personal level. I'd say, of course, like, anybody knows this but me. I was kind of ducking my head at that show because I knew a lot of old, like, ECW Arena heads were there. And people just, because I got sick of people asking me about Barbed Wire City at that point. I was just like, I guess it's not coming out. I guess it failed at life. I couldn't get this one thing done. Just a normal citizen. I don't know what to tell you. And because of that show, I had people calling me with renewed interest because the arena was shutting down. Of course, we know it's still running to this day.
It's still running shows, yeah.
Well, it's just it looks different. And the humorous thing is that a year and, 2 to 3 months later, we'd be having the premiere of Barbed Wire City there. And it was a complete shell. It was like we did it in a building that had nothing in it. No stages, no nothing. It was gutted. But so, I spent the next year and a half living the Barbed Wire City thing. So I wasn't really going to any shows doing it. And the only stuff I was going to was stuff for work kind of a thing. Or I was doing it to as almost like a journalist would, if that makes any sense. Like I would be invited by journalists or other people, and I'd go or by promoters, and I'd go backstage and talk to people and hang out and barely watch the show kind of a thing at that point.
So
my relationship was totally different for about 2 years there with wrestling.
So the documentary came out, and I want to talk a little bit about your third act. You found a little promotion called CWF Mid-Atlantic down in North Carolina.
Yeah.
How did you discover it? Talk about your love affair with CWF Mid-Atlantic and your, I guess, breakup.
How does anybody in our age group discover anything on the internet from the late 90s until now? Dylan Hales. Dylan Hales.
Well, I was going to say porn.
My God, right. Porn and wrestling, all Dylan Hales. I'll
let's not attribute the porn stuff to Dylan.
Ben is involved in this, Dylan. We are both saying it. This is a joint statement. Dylan and I have been friends for years. We got, we knew each other, but we didn't know each other until we got hooked up through our old friend Will from Texas, who I'd known forever. And, I started doing a lot of podcasts with Will and Pete, and Dylan would be on, and Chris Zellner. that old gag. So Dylan and I started talking more. Dylan became a consultant on Barbed Wire City, and sadly some idiot who was not me or Kevin misspelled his name. So if you look in the credits of the Barbed Wire City, if you happen to be one of the few people who has one of about like 2,000 to 3,000 copies out there, Dylan Hayes, who's listed in the credits, is actually Dylan Hales.
Oh, Dylan Hayes.
Yeah, Dylan Hayes. And I called him immediately to apologize. I was freaking livid, but what can you do except throw a diva fit at that point? You know, like, there's nothing, and just apologize. He took it better than I did. Dylan, so the G1 in 2015, the G1 is happening, and I'm trying like hell to get into New Japan. I'm rudderless at this point. Like, post-ROH, I'm a single-serving match fan. I'm the worst. What I realize now, or realize a few years later, was the worst thing possible. Somebody who doesn't follow promotions, who gets mad at matches where it's like, it doesn't end for what you want to be this perfect five-star match, because, I don't know, a promotion's actually trying to tell a story, and it gets in the way of you with your single-serving bullshit. So that's where I was at, and I was rudderless and wondering, like, what am I doing? Watching wrestling still. Tanahashi had this amazing first half of a match with some other, it might have been the year like Ibushi was, I don't even remember. It was 2015, guys. Look up Tanahashi matches and pick one. I was mad at him because he does everything so brilliantly. It's kind of like a Kenny Omega thing where you go, you can do all this stuff, so why can't you put it all together all the time? Why do you do all this stuff just to pop people who are like just going to be fair weather fans of yours anyway? I said, is in 2015, maybe you just can't. Maybe that's just outmoded. Maybe just fans don't like people selling things, because if you work the leg, like, why bother working a leg if you then have to use it as if it's fine 10 minutes later after it gets destroyed? Very artfully, may I add. And that's why I was angry. Because the first half of this Tanahashi match was brilliant. And then Tanahashi, as he always does, goes, oh, my leg recovered because for 3 minutes you didn't touch it. So that means you breaking it in the first 10 minutes doesn't matter. I said, do you think it's even possible? Serious question, Dylan, because he seemed to be as bummed as I was at a match that started out awesome. And he sent me a video of a match and said, yeah, it still can work. Here, this happened just a few months ago. And this is obviously like, you know, July of 2015. And it was a match from one of the first 8 episodes of CWF Mid-Atlantic's brilliant run on their YouTube channel, on a weekly episodic television called Worldwide. And it was Andrew Everett versus, I think it was Ethan Case. And Andrew Everett gets his leg destroyed. He is known for doing a lot of high flying. He continually tries and tries, and it's his Achilles heel. He gets cut off because he's too slow to get his big moves hit because of his knee. And ultimately, he goes for one of his biggest moves, and he loses because the knee gives out. I thought it was brilliant. I started watching a little bit more here and there because I like the announcing.
Mm-hmm.
And
shout out to Brad.
Shout out, Brad. Shout out my boy, C-Bear. Cecil Miller.
Cecil. God love
him. Who's been a great friend to me and has a decent couch to sleep on. Way better than Brad's couch. I'm just going to throw it out there. It's a love seat, and it's kind of fallen through, and he always apologizes, but I'm gonna love seat shame the man and his wife. I kept kind of tabs on them. I got to give a shout out to our dead homie, King of the Irish Goodbye, Dustin Spence, who periodically just pops into my mentions and makes fun of me and then runs away. I love the man. Spence and Dylan and a few others were like following Trevor Lee's title chase and rise. I mean, he'd been rising for a few years there, but I had to go back to watch a lot of that stuff. But I caught on to the fever of his title chase. And I was one of the people who watched live because different friends of mine had been in the building, including Spence and Bruce Mitchell and a person I didn't know who is now a good friend of mine, Sophia. And they were all like, yo, this match is like 5 stars in that sense of the way we used to rate matches. If you're going to throw out snowflakes where it's like, this is be very careful before you throw out a perfect score kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Save your bullets kind of a thing. I watched it live and went, this is brilliant. And then I watched it again. A few months later, little did I know that I would be literally deconstructing the match and putting together a video for it less than a year later. So I really, really have seen it at this point. I started interacting with them through the summer as I started watching the show more in 2016 during Trevor's like title run, because he wins it in February of 2016. And then it really hits a point during the summer because he has this amazing, like, PWG meets CWF in the Sportatorium. And I was like, wow, that Andrew Everett, Trevor Lee match is brilliant. And then the angle afterwards with Brad Attitude is brilliant. Who is this Brad Attitude? I start, like, looking through the history more. And I start interacting with people like Grant Sawyer, the head of production. I start interacting with Brad Stutz, who is the lead announcer, and then I find out is the head of creative. I start interacting with Cecil Miller. And there's a few other people that from the promotion that I was interacting with.
Who are all the best people, by the way, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Just amazing human beings.
And I enjoyed that they were willing to talk to me about these things, and they didn't kind of shy, and they didn't try to big boy you or just use you for just simply for promotion. They were having a conversation with you, and they would retweet you, and they were very like respectful to me, just as a human being, not on like some importance level. They just didn't treat me like a mark in quotes. And so we started like, I threw something out there like, man, I'm going to have to go see this building. It reminds me of like the ECW Arena. And before that, the World Class Sportatorium. I'm a building mark. I'm a mark for the small room and atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And, I got DMs from at least two of them. Grant was one of them. I don't remember who the other one was, but it was like, you need to. Please do. How can we help accommodate this? So I called up Bruce Mitchell, who was an old friend of mine from Barbed Wire City, a journalist from the PW Torch, a columnist, I should say. He's not a journalist. He's a columnist. Shout out to people who know, who remember those conversations via ECW. I ended up coming down and having dinner with him and going to the show, and I walked in right at 7:30. And again, it's like, oh, wrestling shows, especially indie, a small indie in rural North Carolina, that's going to start 15 minutes late and be a mess. They're probably only putting on the matches on TV that like that are good, like the top three or something. And it turns out like most of the card made TV. and everybody had a spot, like nothing, like even the stuff that wasn't blow away, they knew how to work for that part of the card. They knew how to work their gimmick. They knew how to maximize their position and their talent level. It was very Paul Heyman, what Brad was doing. And the reason I say, like, oh, it's going to start late is we were late. We were bullshitting a lot. And we walk in and we have front row seats. So I walk right past Brad as he's going 30 seconds till showtime, guys. And I walk in and he looks at me and he recognizes me from the Twitter pic. Because I'm an idiot. I use my real face and my actual name on Twitter. So I said to you earlier, like, at some point, my life will be ruined because I'm an idiot and transparent. And as I walk by him, he shakes my hand. He goes, hey, man, thanks for making the drive. It's good to see you, Johnny P. And I was like, oh, wow, that's dumb little things like that. I was like, that's really cool. I've had a few conversations with him, but I just figured he was being polite online. And I was hooked after that night. I came back down a few months later for Battlecade to see the blow off to that brilliant Trevor Lee Brad Attitude feud. I was invited out to breakfast. And that's the first night I met my lifelong friend now, lifelong, starting when I'm in my mid-30s, Jeremy Bryant, who you know very well, too.
And podcast.
JB stayed in my room that night, and we've been real tight ever since, like talk all the time. And we were invited out for breakfast the morning after. I didn't really know JB other than he was also a fan, and turns out he was friendly with them. And since they wanted to talk to me anyway, we all went out to breakfast. We had our Biscuitville Summit, as we jokingly call it now. And I said, Grant, your production is so amazing. Like, you're doing so much with so little. They really didn't have much of anything. And he was doing everything, really, except just doing second cam. It was scrappy a lot of times. Josh Byer, who's a great guy, was second cam. But he was really just trying to get the shots and then hand off the footage, you know. And really, he was being floor directed by Grant without a headset. Grant was literally using basically what he did with me with SCI. I said, hey, you're lead. I've watched you for years live. Like, just tell me what to do. So he'll literally just point or move or he'll see what I'm doing and give me the thumbs up, like, good instinct, I'll follow you. And I said, hey, with all that being said, why don't you do you guys use your history so much from what I can tell. I'm, like, going back and looking at kind of archived stuff on your YouTube. Why don't you do video package? Why don't you like build up the big fights and stuff? Because last night was amazing. Last night was like wrestling Nirvana for me. Brad Attitude and Trevor Lee encompassed so much into that. And I was like, the commentary is brilliant for it, but I wish you could hype it to people beforehand instead of people having to like jump into it and then find out, oh, wow, the commentary is going to fill in the blanks. That being Brad Stutz and Cecil Miller at the time. And he said, you know what? I don't have the time. I'm doing everything, and I have like a real life. And I made the brilliant, you know, I'm being sarcastic because it really made me, it was a great time for me in my life. I said, would you mind if I took a shot at something like that? He goes, I would be honored if you'd bother. Like, thank you. Yes. I said, well, I can show you sample work. And he's like, I've seen the documentary. Like, I know what you can, what, you know, in theory you can do. And that made me feel good, of course, you know. I was like, oh, wow, somebody watched something. So I went home, and maybe 2 weeks later, I had a 45-minute special for them. and then another hype video of something. And that grew, and I did, oh, God, I did how many projects for them by the end? I don't even know. It was over 10.
And they were great. And they were absolutely great. The hype stuff was amazing.
Yeah, and it really threw myself. The only thing that I hated was the I would always bitch about, and I know Cecil and Grant are going to laugh if they hear this. I would just get so hissy fittish about the degradation of audio quality. Just could not find out the best way to keep transferring stuff and not degrade the video quality of stuff. Other than that, I was happy with everything, and it was like a really good time where they gave me some agency and some ownership over some. I love the promotion. I love what they were doing, and I love being able to contribute to it and enhance it, and people appreciating what I was doing. It really felt good on Wednesdays to like be in that community and be talking about things, or have bump into people when I'd be down, and just getting to see everybody and get big hugs. Like, so glad you came back down. Oh my God, I saw that video you did. That was awesome. And then I could be like, hey, when you did this, were you thinking this? Like, yeah, I screwed this up and this happened, you know, just like inner stuff. And then you become friends with different people who work there in all different facets. And it's great. I'm sorry. That's like a big thing, but
No.
It really meant a lot to me. It was a great run.
It was a wonderful run for a time. They had a really good thing for a really good moment in time.
Things change.
We should remember it. We should try to remember. You know, we a lot of us have a really negative taste in our mouths right now because of how it ended. But we really need to look back on the positives and say, you know what, they had a really good thing for a really good amount of time.
Well, yeah, and, like in the moment, I'm not going to be so like level-headed and thoughtful and assentive thought or whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
Like in time, I'm like, well, fuck, this is my happy place and it's over and I'm mad and. And, you know, all these things went on that, like, to this day, it's like, it's hard to talk about because I'm kind of sworn to secrecy from people you wouldn't think, not even accusers, but people who have been accused of things where it's like, here's some information and this may, you know, and I did this wrong and I did this and please don't be public about this. And it's like, but that would be good to say out loud. And they're like, no,
I know.
Let it be. And I'm like, I get it, but I hate it.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I did go back down there after, look, we're being so esoteric, so let me say this much. Brad Stutz was fired. Grant Sawyer, head of production, left out of solidarity to his best friend and also felt that there was other things that he was unhappy with.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, over time, Cecil Miller, he stepped up. He did the best he could to enhance the product, both as the lead announcer, moving from color, and trying to help out whoever was his color on any week, given week. But also he began to edit it after a while. He tried to bring World back to, and I think he did a hell of a job.
He did.
And I've told him that privately. I don't want to say it publicly.
Worked his ass off.
He worked his butt off not only to bring it back, but to put his own touches. He didn't want it to just be great. He, you know, still friendly with Grant, but he wanted to make his own mark. And I told him, and I said there were certain episodes that I did watch because of him. And I said, I wish that things were like they were, because you're doing all this amazing work and there's, you know, a fourth of the people are watching it. And that's unfortunate. And then eventually Cecil left. His last show was, you know, Trevor's last show.
Yeah.
I went back down after, 10 months? 10 months of kind of, you know, talking in the background and keeping low, because I was so affiliated with that regime. That it was like online, like, you know, for the little base that they had, it was like people like our friend Pete, who had an audio show, would just go like, oh, Johnny P had done this and this and they should talk to him. And like, I was talking to the promotion at the time, the people in it, but I was so associated with the prior regime. And I didn't want to just renounce them because of things that had happened. And even if it had been the worst case, and the worst case rumors were not true and they were a little bit over the top. And I know that that's where a lot of the bad feelings come from,
yeah.
from people who do care about Brad, because Brad did say, hey, I did some wrong stuff, but I didn't do this and this. And he felt a little sandbagged, and like his era was really stripped. Everything that they did was kind of stripped. So mm-hmm. at the same time, though, I was talking to people in the promotion, and they felt, hey, you got to understand this and this. And I get it. I get it. I also get that they saw people like me as being courted by that Brad and Grant, like, let's bring in the internet crowd and get the buzz going and blah, blah, blah. I don't think that they understood that we were all real life friends. I think they just were like, you know, they thought as carnies, like, well, you dumb marks are being used, and, you know, you buy these special VIP seats and you think you're part of the show or something. And that really wasn't true. Honestly, because I know all the people that would be in that position, and they just wanted to enhance it. I never got comped. I was in the building for every show that I went down to. I was in the building 2 hours early. I still paid for everything.
Yeah.
Because I loved the product and I didn't want to be comped. Because it's they have small margins. At the end of the day, here's the best analogy I can make, and I'll shut up about that stuff. Because there was a line that I always try to walk when I talk about this, even privately, let alone now publicly. The best analogy I can make, you're a sports guy like me. They were this little unknown 2A high school football thing, football team that got a head coach who wanted it to be a big high school promotion. He got the best offensive coordinator he could, who was his best friend, who had these amazing plays. And they found a rookie quarterback who was a once in a lifetime guy who was going to be not just a major college star, but an NFLer in Trevor Lee. And they built around him. They had people in the right position. Some of them could go on to do bigger things. And some of them, they were just going to be weekend warriors for that promotion. But in that context of that promotion, they were invaluable. They were talented for that spot. And they started courting attention. And they nurtured that attention. And reporters were coming in, you know, and fans were coming in from out of town. And now, like, the seats at the old high school football stadium are all filled up, and you have standing room. People are coming to this small town in Texas, or whatever you want the analogy, however far you want to take it. And I really think that the normal week-to-week fans and a lot of the people in the promotion were like, I don't want this attention. I don't use the internet for this. You know, I don't – our high school football team, you know, to keep on the analogy, is always going to be here, and we don't need this, and this is too much. And there's too much – now people are nationally are critiquing our football team and our school and all this stuff, and we just we're humble people. We don't want this. And I think once they fired the head coach and the offensive coordinator left, and the blue chip quarterback said, hey, I'm going to Alabama at the end of the season. I've signed. And then I'm going to head off to the New York football Giants or whatever. They said, okay, cool. Well, the rest of you, could you just leave and let us have our little world back?
Yeah.
I feel sympathy for that. I think that that some people have lashed out in different ways on both sides of things. But I think at the end of the day, look, they're human beings who are trying to escape just like us. And every 2 weeks, they get to be wrestling stars and do their job. And that's true of anybody who ever wrestles. So I have sympathy for that, and I get it. It's unfortunate. I don't think that they see it the way I see it or the way other people do. But they just kind of want to be left alone, I feel, you know?
That's fair. That's entirely fair. I just
I still hate it.
And we'll let them have their fiefdom, and that's fine. It just it sucks because I really enjoyed it. I went out there.
Yeah, I know. You were there. It's in my notes.
Yeah. And we had a blast.
Those are special to me.
We had a blast.
It meant the world to me to see that you came to the fan con that we ran, and we had that. There are two really special moments for me, in a lot of special moments in that, like, 2 year period. And one of them is second night of Chronodal Cup. Trevor versus Chip Day, which is kind of like added on the Wednesday before the show, just to be the semi-main event buffer between the semifinals and the finals of the Chronodal Cup. It was arguably the greatest match I've ever seen live, and you know, and it's up there with Kobashi and Joe.
Yeah,
it's up there. It's up there with, you know, what did we say before? Morishima and Danielson, which I think won match of the year that year back when the world was much smaller and there was more of a consensus. I got so emotional at the end of that. I first walked over to Dylan Hales, who had pushed Chip Day to me for a decade, and I was just like, I just don't see it. He's fine, but I just don't see it. And I walked over and I shook his hand. I said, "You win this one. Thank you." You know. And he gave me a quick hug. And then I walk over to Grant. As soon as he finishes taping, he comes right to me. And I was making a beeline to him, and he goes, "What'd you think of that? You know, like, pretty good, huh?" And I start to say something, and I'm not embarrassed to say, I got choked up. And he goes, "Geez, man, you all right?" And he smiles, because he was like, "This is great, but also, like, I wasn't expecting you to cry." And I just choked out, like, "Thank you so fucking much, man."
Yeah.
Like, I know what this looks like, and it's ridiculous, and it's also beautiful. It's awesome. That and being there with Dylan and Lana and JB and Kim and all those people, and then again when we watched Kane, who has kind of became like my buddy and became friends with a lot of the people who had come from out of town. He was the young guy who was just better than he should have been right away, and Trevor's protege. Just him taking that beating and surviving in the Rumble and being the second to last person, and the emotion that came out of us at the end there, and the locals are yelling and we're yelling, and then at the end him and his girlfriend at the time showing up at the Ramada and going to me and JB's room, and he just looked like he'd been through a war, and him just like laying on the floor while we all watched wrestling, and just him and I think Ace came, and all of us just bullshitting. Those are like, you can't replace those memories, you know?
Yeah.
It's really good.
It's been a hell of a run, Johnny. It's been a hell of a run.
So I to finish that up, man, I was hell-bent on watching Trevor's final matches, and I enjoyed them for what they were. I think that history will look at them much nicer as long as they are eventually put out and edited and put out with production and full commentary. Because I know my buddy Cecil called his ass off for those last three big matches that Trevor had that I went down for. And I was kind of done to some degree. That it was a perfect closing point. When Kane and Trevor went 75 minutes, Trevor laid down the belt. We had this beautiful hour and a half like ceremony of people thanking him and him thanking them. And it was just this beautiful emotional thing. And it felt right, you know?
Hope it gets out there, man. Hope it gets out there.
Me too.
Well, Johnny, it's been an absolute pleasure, my friend. You are, like I said, you are basically a blood brother to me.
Thank you, sir.
I cannot wait to see you in a few weeks at SCI. Hopefully, we'll have more of those moments.
I hope so, too. Yeah. I'm taking a break so that I can be ready for it, because I think it's the passion's still there.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. SCI is my moment. That's my weekend. And
I think I get to watch it this year, too.
Yeah. Oh, you don't have to film it.
I haven't been contacted, so cool. I'm under the impression that they're good. I'd rather not, but I will, you know, if I have to, because friendships, you know.
Yeah, exactly. All right, my friend. Well, enjoy Al Horford.
Yeah.
Kills me. Absolutely. Kills
enjoy
me.
Kemba.
I will.
I think we're both kind of pouting right now. So. it's what, 2-3 hours.
Into free agency, yeah. We're recording this on Sunday night, and D'Angelo Russell just went to the Warriors.
Are you serious?
Yes.
All right, get off the air. Let's be done.
We're gonna get off the air. We're gonna watch Woj do Woj things. All right,
Woj bombing it.
Love you, my friend. I will talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.
Days are